There are some what now questions to answer about interest rates. We'll do a bit of that. You remember the Yule log? We're going to do that too. Also, a chat with Wolfgang Puck from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, the 17th day of December. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. We can call this, I think, quite fairly, day one of the Janet Yellen era at the Fed. An era to be marked, taking her comments yesterday as a guide, because she said we could, of gradually rising interest rates. Assuming, of course, nothing bad happens. Banks have already started to react. They're raising the rates they charge you to borrow money, but not upping what they pay you on your savings accounts. It's a sign of the long hangover that 0% interest rates have left this economy with, because strange as it may seem, banks right now, they really don't want your money. Marketplace's Mark Garrison gets us going from New York.
You know that awful relative who always gives people stuff they don't want. Books for kids not old enough to read, cheese for the lactose intolerant. Right now, banks do not want you to be that person giving them money they don't want. So they're not going to give you higher rates on deposits.
The system remains awash in cash, and so they don't have a huge incentive to do that right now.
That's Mark Hamrick with Bankrate.com, which tracks rates and has the average money market account paying a mere 0.1% interest. Not wanting money sounds weird, because regular consumers think of banks as places that hold their money. But banks are in the business of making money. Campbell Harvey is a finance professor at Duke's Business School.
They'll jack up the borrowing rates, but they will not put up the savings rates, and that just drops down immediately to the bottom line. It's a pure play for profit.
Big banks have more money than they need. Charles Kenji Whitehead, a Cornell professor and former banking attorney, explains that when you give them more, it just drives up their costs.
Things as basic as sending out monthly statements or dealing with customers by telephone or in person. So there's a cost, and it only makes sense for the banks to do this if they think they can get a return.
You can shop around for online banks and other upstarts who'll pay you higher interest rates, but the big banks just don't want your cash and won't anytime soon. If that reality and the skimpy interest rate that comes with it makes you sad, just remember, it's not personal, it's just business. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
There is much counting of political noses in Washington today. Leaders in Congress trying to round up the votes to pass the big omnibus spending bill they're working on. As happens approximately all the time when legislation runs 2,000-some-odd pages, there is a whole lot in this thing for the energy sector in particular. One provision would end the decades-old ban on exporting crude oil from the United States. It also offers up a 5-year extension of solar and wind tax credits, a huge boost to the domestic non-fossil fuel energy market. Gigi Dubin has more on that.
In case you haven't noticed, the cost of renewable energy, especially solar, has dropped enormously over the last few years, something like 70 or 80% in some places. That's thanks in part to the government's industry tax credits. And if these new incentives come through, look to pay even less for solar panels and electricity on the grid. Michael Levy is director of the Greenberg Center for Geoeconomic Studies.
The more solar energy we install, the more we learn about how to make it cheaper, which in turn leads to more solar energy being bought, installed, and used.
Ethan Zindler is an analyst with Bloomberg New Energy Finance. He says right now in the U.S., we have about 100 gigawatts of wind and solar installed.
With these changes, we anticipate an approximate doubling or a bit more of total wind and solar over the next 5 years.
Right now, the U.S. generates about 5% wind and solar energy. That would jump to about 10%. As far as dollars, the new tax credits could be a boost of more than $70 billion across the industry, Zindler says. The bad news, according to Levy, is that there's still no big bang that's going to solve our carbon emissions problem all at once.
But this is a pretty substantial down payment on reducing emissions and, more important, on driving down technology costs.
The same technology that'll allow us to cut emissions in the longer term. I'm Gigi Dubin for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, I believe profit-taking is the word you're looking for. Traders gave back yesterday's Fed-induced spike, and then some. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We'll be right back. You run for office nowadays, you know the deal. Attack ads, spin and more spin, ridicule. How about a punch to the side of the head? That's what one young man, presumably a no vote, gave the Spanish prime minister yesterday. Over the past 5 years, Mariano Rajoy's conservative government has turned Spain from a debt-ridden mess into a model of real but somewhat uneven economic recovery. And he is hoping for a reward in elections this coming Sunday. From Madrid, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Street artist Jonathan Harosh is a walking, talking economic barometer. He sells his colourful landscapes to tourists in central Madrid, and he paints a vivid picture of the ups and downs of the Spanish economy.
2008 was terrible. 2010, better. But 2015, wonderful.
Thanks to the ever-weakening euro, holidays in Spain for people outside the eurozone are cheaper. Tourism here has boomed, and Jonathan's takings have soared.
For me, 2015 was the best year in the last 10 years.
Construction has seen a stuttering revival after one of the biggest real estate busts in Spanish history. Consumption is flickering back into life too. Gail Allard of the IE Business School in Madrid says the economy is certainly bouncing back from rock bottom.
It's growing faster than any of the big European economies. It's growing about as fast as the United States right now. So, yeah, there is a strong recovery underway.
Which should mean this Sunday's election will be a shoo-in for this man.
Señor presidente del gobierno, señoras y señores diputados.
Conservative leader Mariano Rajoy helped steer Spain back from the brink, cut the budget deficit and got the economy growing again. But his re-election is not assured. José Ignacio Torrebianco, author and commentator, says the problem for Rajoy is that his party's been mired in corruption and funding scandals.
Secret accounts in Switzerland, parallel account, and so on, you know. So it is a party that it is in a difficult position to capitalize on the benefits of economic recovery.
And that economic recovery has not been evenly spread. Far from it. Unemployment remains horrendously high at more than 20%, the second highest jobless rate in the eurozone. The repercussions of the housing bust continue. Repossessions are up this year, though vigorously resisted by the direct action group Platform for People Affected by Mortgages. The group's Lotta Ten Hunan in Madrid derides all the talk about a rebounding economy.
It seems almost comical that people are talking and that the statistics are showing an economic recovery. That is not the reality for the people.
Reflecting the widespread discontent, two new political parties have emerged in Spain, the anti-austerity Podemos on the left and the more business-friendly Ciudadanos on the right. Alongside the Conservatives and the Socialists, no single party now seems likely to win an overall majority on Sunday. And it's far from clear who would form a coalition with whom. Spain's rapidly recovering economy could soon face another headwind. Political uncertainty. In Madrid, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Some of what's going to happen with interest rates has already happened. Mark Garrison was talking about that up top. Some of it, though, is going to take a while. All of it is going to wind up with us, though, consumers and the businesses that we frequent. So we called up one of our regulars the other day, a toy store owner we talk to every once in a while, and we asked him for his thoughts on what yesterday's rate hike is going to mean to him.
My name is Steve Presser. I own Big Fun Toys in Cleveland Heights, Ohio. You know, obviously everything's tied to interest rates, so credit cards, variable rate mortgages, and so any time a rate goes up, it adversely affects our consumer base. With interest rates going up, does it decrease their disposable income? In theory, it does, but I don't know if it directly or psychologically affects them immediately. As interest rates go up, the cost to do business usually goes up. Our consumers have to pay more on their loans or their open-ended investments out there. You know, the shrinking, the retraction, the decreasing, the increasing, these are things that, you know, will eventually have a trickle-down effect on all of us small businesses out there.
Steve Presser, the owner of Big Fun Toys in Cleveland Heights, Ohio. Coming up.
You know, I always tell people I'm only at the beginning. So the beginning was all right so far.
Wolfgang Puck, chef, restaurateur, and global brand. Straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials gave back, as I mentioned, 253 points, 1.4%, 17,495. The NASDAQ off 68 points, 1.3%, 5,002. The S&P 500 fell 31 points, 1.5%, ended things at 2,041. The energy sector was a drag on the broader markets. Shares in ConocoPhillips gave back 4%, Chevron off 3%. The tanker company TKLNG Partners took it on the chin after cutting its quarterly dividend by 80%. Shares were down by 55%. Its parent company, the TK Corp, was off 58%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.22%. Rate hike? What rate hike? You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Here's a sign of the times for you, albeit a rather bleak one. Today, for the first time ever, finance ministers met in the Security Council at the United Nations to discuss terror group financing. U.S. Treasury Secretary Jack Lew led the gathering, which passed a resolution co-sponsored, by the way, by both the U.S. and Russia, aimed at focusing global attention and resources on blocking the Islamic State's access to the international finance system. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson has that story.
ISIS is very, very well funded, but it also burns through lots of cash, providing services like sewage or trash removal in the territories it controls, paying tens of thousands of soldiers.
So when you add it all up, they're taking on a massive amount of expenditures in a way that a group like Al-Qaeda never did.
Adam Zubin is the acting undersecretary for terrorism and financial intelligence at Treasury. He says that need for cash, it's a vulnerability. Disrupt that funding, and you may disrupt ISIS's whole narrative of building a caliphate. So a big part of the UN resolution passed today is about better sharing of information.
That doesn't sound sexy, but I can tell you, after 11 years of working on terrorist financing issues, that's where we tend to catch the bad guys.
The resolution also calls on countries to report the steps they're taking to combat terrorist financing and criminalize that financing, even if it's not pinned to a specific terrorist act. This is the first time finance ministers have met at the Security Council, but there have been resolutions on terror financing before. So, big deal or not?
It could be a big deal.
Matthew Levitt is the director of the Counterterrorism and Intelligence Program at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He says there's definitely room to improve how governments communicate, especially about the Islamic State.
It's government informing the private sector. This is the type of thing we're looking for. Private sector, meaning banks, therefore saying, hey, we're seeing this type of suspicious activity.
But Levitt says ISIS derives much of its funding from oil and extortion slash taxation, two areas largely out of the reach of finance ministers. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
The odds of a white Christmas on the East Coast are pretty slim, I'd guess, with the spring-like weather they're having back there. But the calendar, as we know, waits for no one. So right now, another installment of our series, The Holidays, brought to you by, featuring that perennial phenomenon, the Yule log. That image of a roaring fire accompanied by 1960s versions of classic carols. The Yule log was first broadcast by WPIX Channel 11 in New York in 1966, and it is still somehow going strong. Ashley Milne-Tite has our story.
The original film from 1966 only lasted a few years, but the next version, the fireplace so many people still watch, has leaping flames, glowing coals, and gleaming brass andirons on either side. It conjures up the very heart of a winter night. And it was filmed on a blistering August day in California in 1970.
There are photos of the production assistants, and they're wearing short-sleeve shirts, they're sweating, getting the scene ready to record.
Ron Simon is curator for television and radio at the Paley Center for Media in New York. He says TV critics at the time were pretty snooty about the Yule log broadcast. He says they'd hardly have believed it could survive into the 21st century. It almost didn't. The show ran each Christmas until 1989, That's when the station that created the Yule Log, WPIX, or PIX 11, got a new boss. He pulled it from the airwaves. Rolando Pujol of PIX 11 explains.
The Yule Log was seen as kind of a relic, not to mention the station lost money on it. I mean, there's valuable advertising that we are not showing.
But the audience didn't sympathize with those business reasons. Fans saw the station as a grinch. Reaction came swiftly.
People wrote in voluminously. They were upset, hoping that the station would change its mind.
It didn't. Until the Christmas after the 9/11 attacks, when a new station manager decided Comfort TV was in order. The station brought the Yule Log back in all its kitschy glory. Pujol says it's still no moneymaker. The station has never made a DVD of the show or even a YouTube channel.
You know, there's a lot of music. There's 4 hours of music, and I think the licensing aspect would be such a potential can of worms that we haven't really opened it at this point.
He says licensing all those old songs for endless plays would be hugely expensive, but you can find plenty of imitation burning logs out there. Susan Lewis felt warm and fuzzy after coming across one of those when she was channel surfing last Christmas. She lives in San Jose, California, and her TV sits right where the fireplace used to be.
Taking a brief pause in your day to watch something and to de-stress in front of a fire, whether it be a real fire or fake fire, it's comforting, and you need that time. You need that break.
Lewis is relaxing in front of a 46-inch flat screen. Back at the Paley Center, with Yule Log carols in full swing behind him, Ron Simon says when the log first burned for New Yorkers back in 1966, few viewers even had color TV.
I looked at the records. It was about 20% of people had color, so most people were actually seeing the first Yule Log in black and white. But it was a way to promote the idea of color television.
That was Christmas past. The log is now firmly rooted in Christmas present. The Yule Log has its own Facebook page and Twitter account, and Rolando Pujol will be live tweeting this year's broadcast. Okay, he says, none of this may translate to actual dollars, but...
It's good business, I think, in the sense that it generates goodwill for the station, and it's also brand building and awareness for a hot minute, if you will forgive.
He says no one wants to extinguish that. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
The restaurant industry is a notoriously difficult place to make a buck. Margins are thin and competition is fierce. But over the past three decades or so, an immigrant without a high school education, let alone a fancy culinary school degree, has built a global empire worth more than $400 million and in the process become one of the most famous chefs in the country, if not the world. Wolfgang Puck opened Spago here in Los Angeles back in 1982. Now he's got restaurants all over the world and his name on everything from cookware to cutlery to canned soup. He's also credited with launching the open kitchen concept, the gourmet pizza movement, and really the whole idea that a chef is more than just a guy who cooks. So the other day we went out to his restaurant at the Bel Air Hotel for this installment of our segment Conversations from the Corner Office, although in this case, corner booth really is where we sat.
We're expecting you. Won't you have a seat?
Ready to go to work?
Give me the Wolfgang Puck origin story.
The origin story? Well, yeah. I was born in Austria 66 years ago in 1949. Went to school until I was 14. I started out. I had a stepfather who was terrible, really, with me, with my mother. He was drunk all the time, and he always told me I'm good for nothing. So then I started to work in Villach, in this small town, in a hotel called Hotel Post. And about a month into work, the chef told me the same thing. He said, you're good for nothing. I'm going to fire you. You're going to get fired, so you can leave. Because we didn't have enough potatoes for lunch or whatever. It was all my fault. I was like that high and 14 years old. So then I said, you know, I cannot go back home because my father told me, you know, so you're good for nothing. You're going to be back home in a month. So then I went to the bridge and I said, I much rather kill myself. I jump in the river than going back home.
Wow.
So then after standing on the top of the bridge for like an hour, all of a sudden I said, you know what? I'm just going to go back tomorrow and see what happened. So then I went back home. I couldn't sleep all night. Went really early in the morning to the restaurant. And the apprentice who was ahead of me was so happy to see me there because if not, he would have to peel potatoes and do all that. Did that for 3 years, from 14 to 17. And then I found out that the food in France was more interesting and better. So I wrote every afternoon. I was in my room writing letters to Trois Gros and Bocuse and La Tour d'Argent and Maxime's and whoever had 3 stars at that time. And then finally, the first one else that was Beaumanière, which is in south of France near Avignon. Yeah. And so I started to work there with Monsieur Tuilier, and he really became my mentor. He had his own vineyard. He had his own garden. Like, he had 6 gardeners. So we got everything fresh from the garden every day. And that changed my whole way of looking at food. Up to then, I didn't know if I'm going to be a cook or maybe a truck driver.
Hmm. So how did Wolfgang Puck become Wolfgang Puck? I mean, you come to the States in the early 70s. Yeah. You get a job in a couple of restaurants. Nothing works out. And then
well, I got this job at Ma Maison, where I met a lot of people who were very...
Ma Maison here, right?
Ma Maison in Los Angeles, yeah. There I met Orson Welles and Billy Wilder and Sidney Poitier and all these people. So when I opened Spago in 1982, I knew these people and they all started to come to Spago. So I wanted Spago to be a neighborhood restaurant, but it became this huge success.
How important is it for you as a chef to influence culture? Because that's kind of what you've done.
Yeah. I think when we opened Spago, we were the first restaurant with an open kitchen. Before, you had all these fancy restaurants like Jason's, whatever. They brought your seafood on an iceberg, basically like that, and some ketchup with horseradish and everything. So that was the traditional thing, and they cut maybe a steak in front of you. But there was no imagination because it wasn't a chef who ran the restaurant. It was some owner or a maitre d' or a director of the restaurant. So when I started Spago and Paul Prudhomme started K-Paul in Louisiana, in New Orleans, we were really the first chefs who controlled the destiny of the restaurant. We cooked whatever we felt like, not what somebody told you, you know.
Are you okay when people call you the first celebrity chef?
I hate that word, celebrity chef.
All right.
So
you're not okay then?
No, I'm not.
But here's the thing. I mean, you kind of made that happen, right? You got celebrities in your restaurant, and you became the guy, and now...
Yeah, but that's not who I am. I don't walk around with a Brioni suit.
Yeah, we should say you're wearing blue jeans and a chef's jacket. And that's about it. You haven't shaved in a day or two.
Exactly. So I don't look out for the money first. I like to do projects and do them as good as I can, as well as I can, and then hopefully we make money with it.
You are a conglomerate, right? You've got Wolfgang Puck, your enterprise, and then there's 3 operating divisions, and you're in airports and all that stuff. Have you sold out a little bit to make the money that you get out of the airports and the frozen pizza and all that stuff?
You know, I don't believe I sold out at all because I still control everything. So if we have a restaurant in the airport, we have a commissary where we make the soups, where we make the pizza dough, where we make the cheese mixture, where we make the pesto. So that way it's everywhere the same. So does everybody go to Spago or to the Bel Air Hotel every day? No. Sometimes people stay home, and sometimes it's good to have convenience food. I mean, I remember my little boy, Alexander, one day. I made some dish at home. He didn't like it, and he went in our pantry, took my can of minestrone soup, and says, "I just want soup," and threw the soup on the table. So I said, "Well, you know, if the kids like it, so it's a good sign."
Do you ever look around and go, "Yeah, I did all right"?
You know, I always tell people I'm only at the beginning. So the beginning was all right so far.
Wolfgang Puck at the Bel Air Hotel about a week or so ago. The new episode of our Corner Office podcast is out today. The full interview with Wolfgang Puck, his biggest failure, his thoughts about Yelp, and why there aren't more women chefs. It's on our website, of course, or if you like, wherever you get your podcasts. This final note on the way out today, perhaps the greatest on-the-record denial of anything ever by the FBI. Martin Shkreli, the CEO of Turing Pharmaceuticals, which you might remember, bought the rights to a decades-old drug and then overnight boosted the price 5,000%. He was arrested this morning on an unrelated charge of securities fraud. Shkreli, though, is also the guy who a couple of weeks ago bought the only copy of the latest album from Wu-Tang Clan, literally the only copy
for $2 million. Rumors were flying all morning the FBI had seized the album, leading to this tweet from the agency's New York office, quote, "No seizure warrant at the arrest of Martin Shkreli today, which means we didn't seize the Wu-Tang Clan album," end of quote. Personal comment here, it's kind of too bad because now we might never know. Fed, what Fed? The Dow gave back 253 points today, 1.4%. The NASDAQ off 68 points, 1.3%. The S&P 500 down 31 points, about 1.5%. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.